Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Finance Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, January 27, 2015. The time is 1:30. Members present are Representative Wilson, Guerra, Pruitt, Sadler, Co-Chair Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Newman, Representative Munoz, Edgman, Gaddis, and Guttenberg. We're all here. We do have a quorum. Today's agenda is a revenue forecast and oil and gas production tax credits, the FY16 Department of Revenue Department overview, if we get there. So we'll see how the questions move along today. You know, we put the tax credits questions out there, so we have a little more time for the public to get into that because we thought it was going to be part of a large part of Department Revenue's overview anyhow, so we decided to just jump right into it and see what our new commissioner knows and what his staff is recommending to him. Commissioner.
Chairman Newman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Randy Hoffman. I am the Commissioner of Revenue.
A little bit louder, Randy.
Sure. My name is Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. And our initial presentation today on the production forecast is going to focus not so much on the numbers. We will get to the numbers, but on the kind of the how and the why of the forecast. You know, how was it done? Why were certain assumptions made? Because there's obviously been a lot of concern because of the tumbling oil prices and whether or not this forecast is still a reasonable forecast. I think that decision is much easier made when you understand the nuts and bolts of the forecast itself. So that will be the primary focus of the forecast is how we got to those numbers. Dr. Takatsky, our chief economist within our economic research group, will carry most of the load on the presentation since it's his group that put together the revenue forecast and publishes the revenue sources book. But I will introduce the topic and get us started and then turn it over to him to walk through the details of the subject.
Thank you, members. Just, again, that's time management here. We're an hour and a half, 2 hours. Got a lot of stuff, material to go through. Pertinent questions, try and keep them, you know, in line with where we're at without getting down too many rabbit trails here. But certainly ask questions. We always encourage questions and you know what to do.
The primary focus of our forecast is petroleum revenue and secondarily non-petroleum revenue. Obviously, petroleum revenue is our largest income component, and so therefore it gets the bulk of the attention. Petroleum revenue includes not only the production tax, the severance tax, but royalties, corporate income tax, and other oil-related taxes, primarily property tax. And we also then forecast directly non-petroleum revenues as well. That's one bucket of money that we deal with. The second bucket of money is our investment revenue. And that for that forecast, we primarily depend upon our investment advisors, Kalen. They actually provide the forecast. It's largely long-term trends with some adjustment for market conditions. And then the third bucket is the federal revenues that come in. And those, we forecast what's actually authorized for spending, but typically the actual revenues come in 20 to 30% less because simply we don't meet all of the match requirements because not all the work gets done in any given year. Those are then compiled into the revenue forecast book. To get the kind of the structure of the presentation, we really want to kind of walk down exactly the way that the forecast is put together as well. So if you look about a third of the way down the page here, you'll see a formula that says net value equals price times production minus cost. So those are really the three areas we're going to walk through. We're going to look at price, we're going to look at production, we're going to look at cost to build up then the revenue forecast. That creates net value, takes that times tax liability, and then the final component is the credits that are deducted that are taken against the liability. And we'll probably not touch too heavily on this presentation on the credits simply because we have an additional presentation on that following. There was some concern when there was the big change between the spring forecast and the fall forecast that there had been significant changes in how the forecast was put together. But the assumptions are the same, the methodology is the same, the people that made the forecast are the same. The big difference is quite simply oil price. That's the driver of it. It flows through the forecast in a lot of different ways. So oil price is the big driver. And then there was some adjustment for production as well. We have seen a slight uptick in production. That information became available between the spring forecast and the fall forecast, when it typically does. And we see that there's actually been some additional investment and additional production, so we're forecasting slightly more production. With that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Tkoski to talk about the details.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is John Tkoski. I'm the chief economist for the Department of Revenue. I'm going to try to take you through some of the slides at a crisper pace, just so that, with your permission, if we can see sort of a larger view rather than drill down into all the details. But this is a good place to start because it gives a long-term history of the production and shows how our forecast, which you will see, we have an increased forecast, especially for several years going forward, how it fits into the larger picture, just to put things into perspective. I really enjoy the longer-term view. But, yes. I'm sorry.
Go back to slide 7.
Certainly.
So when we look at forecasts here, does that include estimates on future production because of investments in production tax credits now for new investments?
That's correct. So the way the methodology works is that every October we interview almost every active company, including the exploration companies or companies that are planning to produce, and we summarize that in addition with modeling of currently producing fields and wells, and we come up with an overall production forecast, and that uptick in later slides you'll see will magnify that, is what when people were reading in the press that, oh, there's going to be more production, but because of the criteria that we use to include the production in our forecast, we don't sort of book it until we get confirmation that it is indeed in the business plans of the companies.
So do you have an estimate on how this would change if there was a 2013, 2023 out there, we expect to have a gas pipeline in production? What would that do to forecast for oil?
Well, this is the oil production, but one of the issues that comes up is most of the information that we get is good to 3, 4, 5 years out, but beyond that, companies have a difficulty seeing that far into the future, and we do as well. And so what happens is the decline that you see is a function not just of the physical decline, but it's a function of our certainty. So really out in 2023, we believe, for example, we give you a point estimate that it's 300,000 barrels per day, but really there we believe there's quite a wide range. So if I were asked what's the forecast in 2023, I would say 300,000 barrels per day, plus or minus 300,000 barrels, whereas next year we can say with relative certainty, within tens of thousands of barrels, what is likely to be produced. And we've been extremely accurate since we've adjusted our methodology. Certainly 1-2 years out, there's great certainty. And as you will see in the slides that we provide, we provide you with a point estimate going forward, but we show you some of the range of possibilities in the future. If
Thank
I can,
Jim Gira.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the chart, is the top color in 2015, is that offshore oil?
I believe the very top skin is, I think the skins come in from Prudhoe Bay going to the right to Endicott, and then they get added on from Kaparik satellites over through to Point Thompson. So they layer in as the legend that you have.
So through the chair, the chart I have shows a light green for the top layer that seems to be getting wider on in 2015, which says offshore.
That is correct.
And
Representative Guerra through the chair.
Through the chair. So that there seems to be a slight increase there in two questions. One, am I correct that even if that oil production increases, we don't get any production tax off that oil? And number two, what fields offshore does that reflect?
Representative Guerra through the chair, the offshore isn't what you might consider OCS. There's two. There's the offshore, which we call the offshore, is the 0 to 3 miles, which is state, where the state exerts sovereignty. In addition, there is also we do have a revenue sharing provision from the 3 mile to the 6 mile. But beyond the 6 mile, OCS, that is correct, we have no sovereign jurisdiction. But this is the offshore here is just the offshore oil, which is within our jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you. Just to clarify, Mr. Chair.
Let's keep them short because we got a production list.
Sure. 3 to 6, no production tax, but some share of the federal royalty. Within 3, the state law applies. So what are you saying is our jurisdiction? You said this reflects the oil in our jurisdiction.
I'm sorry, it reflects the oil between the 0 to 3 as well as the 3 to 6.
Thank you.
I believe some of that might be contributed into state just entering into an agreement with Callis Energy on Marathon's Liberty Field for $1.2 billion of investment up there.
I didn't hear all the details of the question. Could you ask? Could you ask the question one more time?
That's okay. We can get it. We can get into that later.
Okay.
We need to keep moving.
And anyway, for the record, it would include North Star, Uguruk, Nikaichuk, and Liberty. This slide shows you the revision between the spring forecast and the fall forecast, and what this gives you is the additional information that we've gained in October. September, October is a critical time for the oil companies. They kind of come up with their plans at that time, and they are able to convey the information to us. This interview process is very important for us in understanding the future. In this year, as you can see, we forecast a increase so that from 2015 through 2017, through 2018, we maintain the production above 500,000 barrels a day. And then the decline rate, as I told you, is a function, not necessarily that it's our belief that the production will decline at that rate, but it is also a function of probability of being able to forecast the future.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it looks like the production is pretty close to what you thought it would be. If the price was pretty close to where we thought, you know, where we ended last year, would our budget have been pretty close to where it should have been? That might be a loaded question.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, yes, the your general question is price a major driver in determining revenue? And the answer to that is absolutely.
But follow up. I guess when one going into this year, we pretty much knew the drop off because the revenue forecast was pretty close to how many barrels we would have. Really, our issue this year has been primarily the price, not necessarily how many barrels are going down.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that's correct. And the other issue is that investment decisions are made on a different time scale, so the price environment collapsing isn't necessarily connected to the investment decisions, and the production is driven largely from what information we get on investment decisions. On a very high level, and you can read these details at your leisure, one of the things that I'd like to point out is our revenue sources book is a great summary of the information that we present. And this year, in addition, it's also the repository of the data. We've put in this very interesting feature, thanks to my staff, fantastically thinking ahead of time, the QR code. So if you were to use your app that is able to identify a QR code, it takes you right to the data tables. So you can have you have an image of every figure that's associated with this, as well as all the data tables. So you're able to, at your leisure, play with the data. The oil production forecast, we basically bin it in three major bins. One is a currently producing bin. One is what we consider undeveloped reserves, and then contingent reserves. And all those three reserves, when added up, give us our unrisked investment case. As you can see on this graph, we give you the point estimate of 2015 and 2016, but then as we go forward in 2017, we begin to risk the unrisked investment case. And the unrisked investment case is basically everything that the industry tells us that they are likely to produce. And then the low investment case is basically if all currently producing wells were to continue producing with no additional investment or wells brought online. And so what we have experienced over the years, and if for those of you who've sat through the methodology issue for production, is we discovered that there are basically two elements that need to be risked. One is that a project is announced, but it's delayed in time. And the second issue that seems to affect the North Slope, or any field for that matter, is that there's an anticipation of greater production on average, and then that those production targets are not reached. When we do our risking, and what's interesting is it's a statistical approach, it's not well-specific or project-specific. That is, we risk across the board, which I think is a good strategy because it's not that we have to put a value judgment. It's just on average we found that these risking criteria are useful. They get larger as you go out in time because of uncertainty, and they're also based on industry standards. They were developed out of looking at some of the classic oil industry expectations chapters. This is more of the same, a little bit to describe how we look at the vocabulary in terms of investment. So we have an unrisked investment case, an adjusted expected investment case, and low investment case. This is an interesting slide. So the green skin, the red skin, and the blue skin are what goes into our price, our production forecast. And the other two give you a feel for what the upside potential volumes might be. So in this way, we at Economic Research Group like to see that the likely probability is that we will be somewhere between the volumes from the developed reserves, and it is realistic to expect a potential volume all the way up to the top of the line, but that's our basic reality. Those are the two goalposts, without any new unexpected discovery or some kind of black swan event. So moving on to the price forecast, the next element.
Representative Gaddis.
Thank you. Just a quick clarification. So could you say that again? What I thought I heard you say is somewhere between the 600,000 throughput and the 500,000 throughput, is that what we're expected in the next few years?
Well, our
could you say that again? I want to be sure I got
our price forecast, our production forecast, which was represented in, and that's what we use as our base case to develop revenue, is along the top of the green line. But based on what the industry tells us is possible to produce or is within their plans, getting to the top of the blue line is not an unrealistic production, depending on price, depending on investment, but it is within the realm of possibility based on the current technology and the status of infrastructure on the slope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Dugansky, I don't know if you have any formal or informal estimate of what production from the 1002 area of the Arctic Slope National Wildlife Refuge might bring to this. Do you have any informal estimate or a formal estimate?
We do not have a formal or informal estimate, and it is not within our 10-year horizon, so that estimate isn't included. And one of the issues is if there's a there's an indication of undiscovered reserves that USGS does, and there was an earlier evaluation of the same level that was done by DNR, I believe I was told in 2009. So there are two references that we could come up with, but that's the only available information, and those aren't reserves. Those are undiscovered resources, which are quite a different category. So on to price forecast. So when we look at prices, we like to look at averages because we're economists, and the average price over this period was 104. But as you can tell, we have and we have an event where price has dropped significantly by almost 50% or more than 50% within a short period of time. However, when looked at a longer-term horizon, looking back to 2007, this is not an unexpected event. In fact, for economists, what is, and certainly for Alaskan economists, volatility is something we're quite used to over the long term. Price stability is something that, although we've enjoyed it for several years, is something that is a bit of an anomaly. What are the key oil price drivers? And there's two factors that we definitely monitor, and that's the global spare capacity. It's OPEC. That's Saudi Arabia. And the second issue is the cost of developing new oil supply. But currently, as you're probably aware, there is adequate supply in the market, which is driven down the price. Currently, there's also weak global demand, and Saudi Arabia is willing to sustain lower prices in order to maintain market share. Our price forecast methodology, every first Tuesday of October, we hold a day-long oil price forecasting session. This year it was on October 7th. What we're very fortunate at the state of Alaska is because of our investment funds, primarily because of the permanent fund, we have access to top-notch investment advice, and using those networks, we often invite top-notch speakers who can speak to both the U.S. economy, the global economy. People are very interested in coming up and chatting to the price forecast session. This past year, we have 37 participants from state government, from academia, from the private sector. It includes the Department of Revenue, Department of Natural Resources, Department of Law, OMB, legislative finance, the university. We have a wide variety of people who are either interested in markets or have expertise in the oil and gas industry. In this particular year, rather than asking people to forecast high, medium, and low, we are trying to get more statistical information. Our general process is a Delphi approach, or we have a modified Delphi approach, which means that we give folks the information, and then they're able to incorporate the information in the during the day in order to come up at the end of the day with their own opinion of the price, and we aggregate those opinions. And this year we asked for the possibility at a P10 or a probability of 10, and we went through the exercise of what a probability 10, probability 90, and what the median meant to come up with, and I'll say in simple terms, a high, medium, and low price. And then we used that median price in order to generate the point estimate that we use for the revenue. Keep in mind that we forecast in real prices, but then when we generate the revenue, we include inflation. So when you see prices out 10 years from now that are in the 120s, 130s, that's not a belief that it's not $130 in today's dollars. That's closer to like 90 or 100.
We have a question from Representative Edgman.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you partially touched upon the question I was going to ask, and that is looking 10 years out, because I recall last year the governor's 10-year budget did have prices that sort of soared into the 120 and 130 range. I think that's the right term to say, soared. But
what they do, excuse me, Representative Edgman, through the chair, what that actually is it's a no-change price. So when you see it just kind of slope up, with a 2.5 inflation rate, that basically means you believe that the current price is the same, taking into account inflation.
Yep. So just
get that.
Yeah, I did. It sounds a bit inflated to me, or deflating, however you want to put it. But if I could, just the question then would be the process that you want to go every. First Tuesday of October, does that set the stage for looking 10 years out?
That's correct. So folks are asked to do the price forecast all the way out to 10 years.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Gaddis.
And real quick, and if you're going to get into it later on, just let me know. So on October 7th, when you met forecast, already we had already taken our downturn. Could you have forecasted the dollar amount that oil's going at now? I mean, did you? Could anybody have?
Representative Gaddis, through the chair. Yeah, there are always people who everybody's got a view of the supply and demand, mm-hmm. And so what's interesting is when prices are very high, there'll always be somebody in the room who'll say like, "Oh, prices are going to drop," and that's just because it's economics. But and oftentimes. Psychologically, it's a difficult thing to say because people in the room are like, well, you know, prices are what they are now. The opposite's also true now in a low-price environment. If when I say, oh, prices will resume to $100 per barrel, not everybody shares that opinion. So,
a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So, you know, and I don't want to belabor it, but I guess but I guess it's a guessing game of sorts. So one could not have forecasted this. Is that what you're saying?
Representative Gaddis, through the chair, it's very difficult to forecast in general, and then it's always a challenge to forecast a great change in direction when something changes from one state to the other. Psychologically, human beings are resistant to understanding change. But as economists, what we do is that's the name of the game. We're always ready to anticipate the change. So when you look, one of the tools that we have is we put the forecast out there as a tool for you in order to budget. And it's a revenue forecast that we give you. We also use the revenue forecast for other for other items. And so, for example, the when we go to the rating agencies, they look at our revenue forecast, and there the view is a little bit different. So when you're looking at the revenue forecast or the price, and oftentimes people are like, well, you wanna budget lower than the expected revenue, just to be on the safe side. And that is what I would say is you look at the glass as half empty. But when you go to the credit rating agencies, well, you want to say, no, look at all this capacity we have. Here's the revenue. It's the glass is half full. So it's a tool, and it's forward-looking statements, and forward-looking statements are what they are.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Excellent.
Ms. Chatsky, just in time management here, we're about 13.72% through our program, and we have about 25 to 30% of our time left. So.
Excellent. I will keep going. This is just short, just so that you're sure of the methodology. We do adapt when prices are low, and so what we've done is we've looked at being able to hybrid the information from the price forecast session. The price forecast is the Department of Revenue's price forecast. It's endorsed by the commissioner. It's a recommendation. When times are changed, we want to make sure that we reflect reality so that you have a credible forecast in order to base your decisions on. A little bit, people always ask, what if the price of oil is X, Y, or Z? Because we've had high prices in the early part of the fiscal year, even if we were to sustain $50 per barrel for the rest of the fiscal year or lower, we're still going to be in an area of $60, $70 per barrel oil, all things being equal. Just to remember that we average over the course of the year. I would like to stop a little bit on this slide. The slide, the portion on the left that says actual, those dots are what the average price was. The black scale is the highest and lowest price for the year, the highest, and so you get to see the range of prices. And then going forward in the forecast, those dots are the price forecast, discrete prices, the specific price that you see in the revenue forecast book, but really those black bands represent what the possibility that we believe and the forecast group thought the prices could be, how low they could go, how high they could go, just to give you the feeling for there is a range of possibilities. And when we provide you with the revenue forecast, we provide you with one kind of alternative view. And that's why we like to do a revision in the spring so that just prior to the end of session, you get a revised view. And as the economist Keynes used to say, when the information changes, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? So we like to change our mind if the information changes. The one notable bit is for 2 years running, 2013, 2014, we had the exact same price to three decimal places. So that's stability, and that's also lightning striking 16 times in one place. So moving on to the revenue forecast, as you know, one of the mainstays of petroleum revenue in low oil prices is our net royalty, the payment that we receive as owners of the resource. The production tax, corporate income tax, they are highly dependent on price. Property tax is not dependent on price. It's dependent on the value of the property. And then we look at non-petroleum revenue, which is pretty much around, I would say, $500 million, depending a little bit of variability, depending on how well the markets are doing or whatever the particular industry is. So, but, of course, actual from 2014 to what our forecast is, we're looking at about half of the revenue. Non-petroleum unrestricted revenues that are non-petroleum, this just gives you an overview Again, if you're interested in the details of how that $500 million comes together, it's given in quite detail within the revenue sources book. I won't belabor that right now in the interest of time. Finally, on the next slide, just to give you an overview, is that investment revenue is not unimportant, although it doesn't go into the general fund unrestricted revenue. The state is still generating revenues off of their assets, and total state revenue for 2014 was $17 billion, which I believe is the second largest total state revenue. And even next year, we're forecasting rather healthy total state revenues, even in the face of lower total unrestricted revenue. Oftentimes, we're asked, what happens if the price is higher or lower? This is a good graph. It's in the revenue sources book, and it's a way that you can gauge. I mean, we're always happy to have the modelers run the models over and over again, but if you want a rule of thumb, flipping to the back to page 83 and page 82, you get a feel for what the revenue is likely to be. And as you can see, between about $80 and lower, the slope becomes flatter, and that's a result of the primarily of the minimum tax. Changes from the spring forecast. There's no secret. Price is different, and that's the major driver for what the change is. A little bit of an increase in production between the spring and the fall, and, of course, the result of a change in price means a drastic change, or significant change, I should say, in the general fund revenue. More of the same on this page, so I won't belabor that, but it's detail that may be useful for you in the future when you refer to this document. Same for 16. We did review our capital expenditure forecast, and of course the driver for our increased production is that we have not only seen but we forecast additional capital expenditure, especially in the near years. And operating expenditures are also increased based on the increase in production.
Shotsky?
Yes.
On that, how does that show the increased investment since, like, 2013?
So if you look at the slide 30, which is the North Slope capital expenditure, what's been we do have the information that's reflected in the revenue sources book, where you will see that in the last year we've seen an increase in investment, but certainly based on our interviews going forward, we see a relatively larger amount. In the fall of 2014, you can see the numbers on the bottom are significantly larger, especially in 16, 17, and 18. Going out to 19, 20, 21, those are of interest, but they're less significant because it's very difficult for the oil industry to they're really giving us very forward-looking statements about their plan.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Edgman.
Just a quick comment. I presume that these are inflation adjusted as well.
These are in nominal dollars.
Nominal. Well, what's kind of thrown me off a little bit is having to compute in my brain what these numbers out several years are, taking out inflation and non-inflation adjusted numbers. It'd be helpful to me to have non-inflation adjusted numbers so I can sit here at my post and do quick comparative analysis, looking out in the future and seeing numbers are like this. I mean, I really don't know how to compare that today.
Representative Edgman, through the chair, that you're preaching to the choir. Economists love to give you numbers in real terms, and We'd be happy to do that. In addition, if you would like, we can provide you with their inflation series, so that if your staff is working on the numbers and you want to match our inflation adjustment, we can do that as well. So you can inflation adjust all of your numbers to match what we do in the revenue sources book.
Mr. Chotsky, if you could just send information to the chair, we'll get it done.
Thank you.
My constructive suggestion, I guess, would be if you can include that on the same graph, just for me, probably the slowest guy here around the table, so I can sit here and understand what these numbers mean looking forward.
Representative Edgman, through the chair, would be happy to reproduce these graphs in real and nominal terms. Yep. If I make one comment, Representative Edgman, through the chair, that most people, we've found that there's a push to, just do it in nominal dollars, do it in nominal dollars. But I believe that a real view is very, very useful. So thank you.
This particular slide we were going to spend some time on during this presentation, but since we're doing a complete presentation on credits, we'll pick up this in the next presentation.
So this is kind of the climax to the presentation, and that's the history looking back. And you can see we have highly volatile revenues, either because investment revenue, these are total state revenues, either because investment revenues are volatile, sometimes they even go below zero. But on average, they're quite healthy. And then we have our petroleum dollars that are volatile, our non-petroleum dollars that are relatively steady. When we look forward, we have it's hard enough to figure out where we think things are going. We don't represent volatility all that well because volatility is usually something that's unexpected. But on average, I think when you look at the 10-year condition, we can give you a pretty good picture of what, on average, you're going to get. Of course, when you on average means that you have to live in a specific world where sometimes you've either got a very good year or a bad year.
Thank you. Looking at the going forward, thank you, Mr. Chair. I see the federal spending is increasing fairly significantly in the out years here. Can you give me a brief idea why that is? In the forecast?
Increasing? It's actually a steady state at 3.1.
I'm sorry, compared to the historical. Continue forward.
So, Representative Sadler, through the chair, that's a function of, if you remember in the first slide, Commissioner Hoffbeck stated that we forecast a certain number, but we only get 20 or 30% of the revenues that actually come in. So the 2.5 that you see, what we anticipate is going to happen is out of the 3.1 that's allocated, okay, we'll only get 2.5. Now, why don't we discount it up front is a question. It's just been a tradition that we do forecast the allocated.
So can we back up to a page?
Sure.
So when we look at the red lines that drop below production net tax of refundable credits, when we look at this, you know, it's somewhat of an anomaly, I think, because of what was done in recent legislation to where these refundable credits are going to sunset in 2016. So beyond that, you won't see anything, right?
Chairman, there are refundable credits that will go beyond 2016. Some of them sunset, but not all of them.
Okay. The refundable credits, basically for the non-larger big producers.
Right. The refundable credits are primarily those that are being claimed by the explorers and those that are currently developing facilities that don't have any kind of revenue being generated from them.
Smaller companies. New investments.
Right.
So you're cashing in using the production credits.
That's correct.
So then let's go to the inverse with the larger companies. And we look at the green, the darker green, and we show the tax credits that are used in there, would that indicate that we're also competitive at low oil prices?
Whether we're competitive at low oil prices, our tax, we're still collecting tax at low oil prices, if that's the question. The difference between the light green and the dark green is the credits that are taken against tax
liabilities.
And so with the minimum tax in place, even at these low prices, we're still going to collect about $500 million in taxes from the producers this year.
But these are production taxes used by the larger companies.
This is generally the big three, yes.
That's what I'm trying to get at. It's the difference between what we see for investments and tax credits between newer companies that are coming in the red, the larger production tax credits that were investments or purchased from others that used against tax liability by the big three.
That is correct.
Just make sure we're clear on what we're looking at there. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. So the only we get less revenue based on those two kinds of credits, but there's a third place where we get less revenue, and I want to ask some questions about that. If I pay a 20% tax, I get a 20% deduction. But no matter how low your tax goes under SB 21 till you hit the minimum floor, you still get a 35% tax deduction too, right? So if you're paying an effective 20% tax, 15% tax, 10% tax, you still get the 35% deduction, right?
Until you hit the minimum tax floor.
Right. Thank you. And then, through the chair. Only some fields have the minimum tax floor. If you're one of those GVR fields, the post-2002 production units, the 4% tax floor doesn't apply. And do you also still get the 35% deduction?
Can we deal with that in the next
sure.
In the next presentation? I think we'll be.
Yeah. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine's actually on the next slide. So with the pricing low, which I don't think it'll stay there, is there a way that you can forecast that maybe companies, including the state who has royalty oil as well, might hold on to, you know, some of the barrels of oils until it, you know, raises the price?
In general, Representative Wilson, through the chair, companies make investment decisions often, especially in the energy industry, they're used to volatility. And so although it depends on whether the price is going from up to down or down to up, it's not always, if it's a low price environment and the price starts increasing, then there's of course a stimulus to want to invest. But you will also see a delayed reaction. That is, we have seen an increase of investment now, which means that we'll see an increase of production and tax revenue, theoretically, in subsequent years. So there's sometimes a disconnect between the price signal and activity.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So maybe I didn't ask it right. So, I mean, wouldn't you... This is what I would do. I mean, I would store the oil until it became worth more money. So would they not do the same thing? Because, you know, by your forecast, you're showing that this may be a year or two. Because this was a substantial drop, not a small drop, but a pretty substantial drop, you know, to where that oil's worth about half as what it was a year ago. So you're not, I mean,
well, there's
along here. It just seems like to me that they would hold back on some of this until it was worth more.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, it depends on the business model, but what you're proposing is basically a hedging activity that you would hold back, or you would produce and then you could store and sell at a different time. But it depends on those kinds of decisions depend on the timing of whether you think the price is going to go up relatively soon, or if you have to hold on to the oil for 10 years or 2 years or 30 days. But, there are people that engage in that behavior. But in general, when you're producing off of a large field, you produce what you can.
Representative Cossack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And kind of along the same line, the same question, because we spent a lot of time on production and anticipated and sort of investment cases on production and then separated price out separately. And I'm wondering if there's a nexus between price and production. Is there a, I mean, and if we have continued low oil prices, at what, I guess another way to put that would be, what production would we have to come up with the same amount of money over those future years?
So Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, the budgeting process and the expenditure amount and the amount of revenue generated are disconnected events. So I recognize that traditionally the states spent or at least had enough revenue to cover the expenditures in recent years, although that hasn't ever been, that hasn't always been the case. But in general, within our forecast period, depending on price, it is not unreasonable to have yearly revenues between $2 and $5 billion. So that's kind of the range of expected revenues, all things being equal, given the current what I would levels of production and expenditures. And then, if I may, Representative Newman, return to Representative Wilson's question.
Yeah, I just stunned Representative Kawasaki's question. That was kind of a roundabout question, say who knows, I think. Representative Wilson.
No, he's going to give you a better answer. Right?
So, oil in the ground isn't oil in the bank. And so if you produce a barrel of oil, even if you get $20 for it, and you use that opportunity cost where you actually have cash and put it in the bank, over 10 years you may be able to get as much oil as the oil price that appreciates. So there's a lot of things that once you turn natural resources into money, there's a lot of things that you can do to get the same or equal value. It depends on what your risk calculation is. But in general, leaving oil in the ground, there's a risk that it will never be produced, and that is a significant risk that petroleum producers as well as the state recognizes over the year.
Can I do just a slight follow-up on that just to make sure?
Wilson.
I know. Okay, it's an oil company, so they deal with this all the time, so I'm not really worried. I'm more concerned revenue-wise whether or not you take that into consideration. So, you know, although we may see the prices fluctuate back up sooner, if those barrels are still, it could be a good and bad, where we'll see less coming out with the prices being lower, but we might be able to rebound a little faster if they did keep some of that in the ground, because we're talking world companies. We're not talking about just being here. So my question really was just, because this has happened in the past, do you even take that into consideration that they may not pump out as fast, as quickly when the prices are low, versus then when it rebounds and gets higher? So it's more on the revenue forecast portion.
Representative Wilson, through the chair. I mean, part of that's a technical question but in general, when somebody is, when there's a facility that's producing oil, it tries to maximize production. That's so that your general manager looks at maximizing production, minimizing costs, and they're blind to price. But you should probably ask oil companies about that. That's just my observation as an economist.
Mister.
With that, I think I'd like to move forward into the next presentation. Thank you.
So when are we doing the credits?
Credits.
You're going to have that. Oh, now I know.
Representative Newman, again for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. I have with me Assistant Chief Economist Dan Stickle. That will, if the questions get detailed, he's here to answer them. The presentation itself is going to be primarily a historical overview of tax credits, kind of the cycle of where we're at in the credit process right now, and then touch briefly on the credits that are expiring to get a feel for what we'll be dealing with moving forward. The credit situation that we're in now is largely a product of four separate tax regimes in the last 10 years, each with their own particular focus, each contributing to the credits that were available to be used by the producers, the explorers, and the developers. The first of the modern era credits came actually during ELF. It was under SB 185 in 2003, and it was a 20 to 40% credit for exploration. It was the range between 20 and 40 was really by type and location. And what's critical here is you could take it against the tax liability, you could sell it to somebody else with the tax liability, or you could carry it forward. But this particular credit could not be cashed in with the state. So you could not. This was not a reimbursable credit. It had to be used against somebody's tax liability at some point in time. The next credits to be added were added with the passage of PPT when we went from a gross tax to a net tax. There was a 20% loss carry forward credit. That actually we'll see as we step through the credits that 20% has changed several times over time, but the initial credit was a 20% credit. We had a 20% capital qualified capital expenditure. This one ultimately expired with SB 21, and again we'll touch on that in a little bit. And then the small producer and new area tax credit. And that one was a $6 million for frontier explorers, $12 million for small producers. The interesting one on that, and we'll talk about it as it expires as well, is it expires in 2016, but it has a tail, a nine-year tail on it that even though it expires, we'll continue to be paying credits for up to 9 years on that one. And then the transitional expenditure credit, and that one expired in 2013. Also with PPT, they added a mechanism for the state to buy back credits from the smaller producers. The smaller producer be defined as somebody that produces less than 50,000 barrels a day, and there was a cap on that of up to of $25 million a year that they could actually, where the state would buy back.
You know how many producers took advantage of that?
I do not know. Do you? How many producers took advantage of that credit?
I don't have the numbers.
We can get that for you.
On that point.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. On the nine-year tail, what is the liability on that particular credit program?
It's published in the revenue sources, but I don't believe it's with enough detail to pull out the tail. Dan, do you have the forecast numbers on?
Sure. For the record, Dan Stickle, Assistant Chief Economist, Department of Revenue. So the small producer credit is a credit of up to $12 million per year per producer for the first 9 years of production. And our forecast for those credits is in the between $55 and $73 million a year in total for all the companies involved. That's from just looking at the forecast for the next 4 years.
Dan, could you, through the chair, Dan, could you please clarify? I couldn't hear you very loudly first off, but the 55 to 73 million was just for the NOL carry forward?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I believe the question was about the small producer credits.
Small producers, okay. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, for FY15 and 16, we're estimating $55 million for North Slope small producer credits, then another $12 million for non-North Slope. So that would be $67 million for 15 and 16, and then we ramp that up to about $85 million total in FY18.
Pull that forward.
Trying not to break your equipment here. Yeah, and we have a document here that I'm not sure if you guys have this or not, but we've broken out a little bit additional detail on the credits information that's included in the revenue sources book. So for the next 2 years, we're looking at about $67 million in total small producer credits, and we have that ramping up to $85 million.
And for the record, I just got information that Lenny Deese is also online. He is our audit master in Anchorage that deals with these on a daily basis. So when we get to Representative Garrett's question, Lenny will be probably the one that fields that question. Then we move on to ACES. And ACES provided minor changes to the credits themselves. The loss carry forward was increased to 25%. And it actually eliminated that $25 million cap on the small producer credit. So now there's no top end on that. And it created the tax credit fund, which is the sub fund of the general fund that you appropriate money to each year. And that's the money that we then use to pay the credits when they are applied for and qualified for. Between ACES and SB 21, there were several Cook Inlet changes that were made to the tax credits and really in an effort to stimulate exploration and production in South Central Alaska. There was a gas storage facility credit that was put in place that allowed for a storage facility to deal with peak demand times to deal with the brownout conditions that Anchorage and the surrounding area was dealing with. It was for the first facility, and that credit was claimed in fiscal year 14 for $15 million. So for the gas credit. There's also one for LNG project, again a $15 million credit. That one has not been claimed yet, but we anticipate it's going to be claimed within the next year or two.
Aren't those credits basically for drilling dry wells?
The gas storage facility credit?
Okay, well, not the gas storage one, but some of those expenditure credits.
Chairman Newman, we hope they're not for drilling dry wells. The next one is a 40% well lease expenditure credit. And that one's, these are just for Cook Inlet. This one's also for Middle Earth as well, so anything south of the North Slope. And then there's a jackup rig credit that was put in place to encourage a jackup rig to come north. Actually, two rigs came north. The credit was 100% for the first well drilled up to $25 million, 90% up to 22.5 in the second well drilled, and 80% up to $20 million for the third well. Nobody's made a claim on this particular credit.
Got any gas?
No, the wells were drilled, but because there were some information sharing requirements that were associated with this credit, the companies chose to use other credits instead of this credit, even though they got less in return.
So I mean, we offered a lot of credits and didn't get any gas.
Fortunately,
we learned some information.
Yeah, we learned information. We didn't have to pay the credits. So. And then the Frontier Areas credit was set up in a similar fashion to the storage, LNG storage and the gas and the jackup rig, and we anticipate that these credits are being claimed in the Nana and Susitna basins. Then credits were modified again with SB 21. SB 21 eliminated the 20% qualified capital credit for the North Slope only. Cook Inlet, that credit remained in place. It created the per barrel credit, which essentially is an offset against the 20% capital credit. They're not precisely the same, but they're kind of the trade-off between the two. Of course, the per barrel credit is an $8 credit at $80 barrel oil, a $7 credit at $90, a $6 at $100, up, and when you hit $150 a barrel oil, the credit no longer exists. That's for old oil. For new oil, it's just a $5 flat credit per barrel. And then the final piece within SB 21 was an increase of the loss carry forward credit to 35%. Actually, it's 45% for 2 years during the transition period. Then it drops back down to 35% in 2016. And again, for Cook Inlet remained at the 25% net operating loss carry forward credit. Essentially, Cook Inlet is still basis. The change within SB 21 was for effects of the North Slope.
That's the obvious question I think others are asking or thinking around here is, here's where we're at now in 21. It's probably a little too early to see the original effects of what happened. Maybe Dan's a help on this one here. How do you see this moving forward? I mean, the investment that the state made, you know, with the credits is to try and incentivize more production, and is that working?
Chairman Newman, we are seeing we did see a response in Cook Inlet, a fairly substantial response, to the point where there's sufficient gas that the South Central is not in jeopardy of running out, and there's actually gas that's available probably for other uses as well. So it did have a response in Cook Inlet. The totality of that response in relationship to the cost of the credits, that's still to be determined.
Mr. Chair, just to be clear, and so I understand, the per barrel credit, that has nothing to do with how much oil you produce. That's just at different prices you pay a different tax rate. Is that correct? So it maxes out at a 35% tax rate around $160 a barrel, but 20% at $110 a barrel, lower at lower prices. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representing Everett, that is correct, except at 150 rather than 160. At 150, I think you go to zero on the per barrel. But yes, it's not a production driven credit. It's just a price based credit. It's just on every barrel you produce. Over the last 10 years, I think it's probably clear to everybody that the size and the applicability of tax credits has grown dramatically. This is just a graphic representation of the two types of credits that we see, one being the credits used against liability, the other the ones that are refundable, where the state actually writes a check for them. And you can see that they've grown over time. The credits purchased by the state peaked at one point in 2011, and otherwise they've pretty much just tracked with oil price. There's not a lot more on that screen except to simply say it's obvious that the credit liability has grown each year. Each year in relationship to the revenues that were being generated by the oil price. This is one thing I think that needs to be clarified, and that's that not all credits should be viewed as a cost. The 20% capital credit under ACES and the per barrel credit under SB 21 really are part and parcel of the tax rate itself. They work together to create the tax rate. And so if you talk about them independently from rate, I think that it doesn't give you a clear picture of the totality of what they're doing. They really are part and parcel of the rate as well. Now, they function differently, but each was intended to be part of the total rate, and And so, particularly with these, with the per barrel credit, we see that actually as a deduction prior to revenue. It doesn't actually show up on the cost line. It shows up in reduced revenue.
Just, I mean, there's a, I think, an important bullet point here with other credits, you know, along with the capital credits were created to encourage a desired behavior in the industry. Pretty good point there. Can you explain how the industry reacted? What does that mean?
It's very easy to explain it in relationship to explorers and new developments. By offering the credits, the state actually takes on part or a fairly substantial part of the risk of exploration and new field development. And it was done so to make marginal fields or more speculative fields economic to develop. It was an investment in the future to try and put have more product produced or more production. For the per barrel allowance, that was and it was a fairly robust debate over several years. It was an attempt to make Alaska's tax system competitive with other tax regimes, and so it that was really aimed more at the people that were producing right now, and to encourage additional investment because it there was an upside as in their investment.
There's upside to the investments into exploration, which creates more jobs to look for more oil.
Correct.
Representative Wilson.
So with that, Mr. Chair, so then who determines if they're really working or not? I mean, is that revenue? Is that DNR? Who determines whether or not the credit that we put out there did what we thought it would? And then whose responsibility is it to come back to us to let us know?
I was distracted momentarily there. Could you repeat the question, Representative Wilson?
Yeah, I actually can. So with the credits, you know, you put in there the certain things that it's supposed to do. So whose responsibility is it to, once a credit's put out there, to measure whether or not we got the results we thought it would, whether that is more production or more jobs or more capital investment? You know, I don't know whether it's revenue, DNR. And then, you know, is there somebody designated that comes back and says, yes, it did work, or no, it really didn't get us where we thought we would go?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's a combination of a lot of agencies, and that was one of the things that I think Governor Walker made clear early on, that he's taking a comprehensive look at credits, and he said after he does that, he'll make a business decision moving forward on that. I think right now, particularly with the SB 21 credits, it's a little early in the game to know exactly what we can see some of the impacts of prior credits, but it's pretty early in the game to see what the impact SB 21 has had. But it is a process that's underway, but I don't have an idea when it will be completed. But it is something the governor is very, very much aware of.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned the qualified capital credits. Last legislature passed a bill dealing with independent expenditures, and part of the analysis from legislative finance was specifically that it was obviously the intent at the time the QC was put into place that gas production would encourage investment in oil and gas infrastructure. And it says the credit actually appears to have been used primarily for investment in maintenance for existing infrastructure. So is that, I mean, it seems to be different. Leg finance is a different opinion about what that qualified capital expenditure credit actually ended up accomplishing.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, that the statement made by is not inaccurate. A lot of it has gone for infrastructure maintenance, but even that has some impact continuing and increased production. So the totality of the analysis isn't complete, and that would just be simply one component of it.
And then a follow-up. Yeah. And then just a brief follow-up. We still don't have an ACES audit, and I'm wondering, we do have an ACES audit. or it's in somebody the, has not been released by. Yeah, there's somebody nodding, people nodding behind. When that will be made public and available for review?
An independent company audit or total audit of ACES in general?
I guess, you know, I mean, we've gone back and forth on whether we should change the system. We did change it with Senate Bill 21. But, I mean, a real problem with it, in my opinion, is that we never had a real accurate look at whether ACES was working or not and what parts weren't and were working. And so the audit was crucial. And I know that, you know, we might be up against a deadline for a look back. And so I just wanted to hear that it was being done or is done.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, if you're talking about individual ACE audits being done on companies, the first of the ACES audits are about to come out or ready to come out. They're close to the end of the 6-year statute of limitations, and I have every assurance from my staff that they will be out before the statute of limitations expires. So PPT is done, and we're into ACES now. And the slide also then touches on Representative Newland's other comment that it created and encouraged the desired behavior within the industry. We did see increased activity.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to slide 8, page 8, please. Could you tell me what portion of the $1.2 billion in credits is attributable to Cook Inlet?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, of the reimbursable credits, about half are attributed to Cook Inlet and about half to the North Slope. Of the credits used against the liability, essentially a 100% is North Slope. So, in totality, about a quarter is reimbursable to Cook Inlet of the total credits.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gare.
Just to understand the bottom blue part, under SB 21, that includes the part that's not really credits, but that is basically the price per barrel credit. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, it's essentially entirely the per barrel allowance that is reflected in that blue.
Okay, got it.
Flipping to slide 10, I guess I forgot to put. This is a history look back to 2007 of the refundable credits, when the refundable credits were implemented. With the light green bar on this one being total production revenue tax before credits, the darker green bar after credits used against liability, and then the red bar being the refundable credits. And you can see over time that particularly the red bar has grown dramatically, but so has the credits against liability. Particularly as a percentage of total revenue.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two things, sir. I'm having a difficult time understanding you. You've got a low voice, and so speak up if you could. And define refundable credits, if you would, please.
The refundable credits are the ones that could actually be cashed in with the state. That's for companies that don't have a tax liability. They can actually essentially sell the credits back to the state.
Thank you.
Can those be other refundable credits that companies who have a tax liability of the state purchase and then use them against their liability?
Some of the credits can be purchased.
Don't tax credits.
Yes, some can be sold to other. Yes. Liability. Yes. The next slide then takes us from history to current day. Same relationship between the bars. The first one is a total tax before any credits. The dark green bar is the production tax after credits against liability, and then the red one is after the refundable credits. And it's the discussion that Chairman Newman you brought out in the prior presentation that the production those that are producing are paying taxes, even in this low price environment. But because of the low prices and the and the cash flow issue that generates, it also generates less tax overall. That when those credits are applied against it, that it does take us below zero as far as our total total take. But there is a bottom limit that those that are producing and have a tax liability will reach. There's not a bottom limit on those that that are using the credits for exploration and development, and you've got a fairly robust economy out there of people that are looking and developing. They told me if I get too close, it feeds back.
Oh, okay. Can't hear you. Sorry.
Okay. We've got a lot of this exploration and development that's occurring because two factors: high oil prices that drove these credits, and now they're showing up at a time when the prices are lower. The other is that actually the expiring credits seem to be generating activity that people want to do the work before those credits expire.
Yeah, there was a multitude of reasons, you know, using them all in 1 year and trying to think that to have fluid capital. That's the problem I have with this chart right here, is it takes a single feature out of the whole tax system, you know, that's somewhat of an anomaly. It shows that production actually has been a positive thing, and it's somewhat of a distortion of the public's perception of how the credits work.
Chairman Newman, you know, we've discussed it in several forums, and I think hopefully eventually we won't have to talk about this slide anymore. So,
thank you. Representative Munoz, do you have a question?
Thank you. Just a follow-up, too, to my earlier question. Does this slide indicate the Cook Inlet tax credits in the total production tax?
Yes. In the production tax net of refundable, the refundable credits are in Cook Inlet, and about half of those are Cook Inlet, about half of those are North Slope. So that does show this, yes.
So this does reflect the Cook Inlet versus the total tax?
Representative Munoz, yes, it does. This is just a general, the same statement that we've made several times before. I don't think we have to revisit it. And then finally, just kind of a summary of the taxes that are expiring. The carry forward annual allowance credit for the North Slope will decrease from 45% to 35% in January of 2016. Again, it stayed 25% in Cook Inlet. The small producer credit stops accepting new producers in May of 2016, but if they have production prior to that time, they can take the credit for 9 years after the date of the commencement of production. And so if anybody triggers their production in the middle of 2016, we could see that credit linger for up to 9 years. And then the exploration incentive credits for the North Slope and Cook Inlet expire in July of 2016.
And these first two bullet points primarily are targeted towards non-producers of not the three large oil companies.
The first bullet actually is both the 45-35, unless I that operating loss can be taken by the producers as well. So the first one is part and parcel of the North Slope overall market, actually, but the second one is focused more on Cook Inlet, but it's actually on the North Slope as well. So.
Check on that one.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Gale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hate the fact that you call something a tax credit that just varies the tax rate based on price, but it is what it is. It's how we wrote the bill. But it makes it confusing. What I'd like to know is, for the last year that we've had a full year of taxes, that's FY14, the effective tax rate, you know, goes down and up with price. Before deductions and the non-per barrel credit, which isn't really a credit, what was the effective tax rate on the producers that paid a tax obviously it wasn't the cap of 35%. Do you know what the effective tax rate was for those that did pay a tax?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, I don't have that offhand, but we can certainly get that to you. Unless,
yeah, we'd, not off the top of my head. We'll get that for you, right. Representative Garrett, through the chair.
I'd appreciate it. I don't know if the committee would appreciate it.
Okay. Any other questions on that for now? We are, were you wrapping up?
We are done with that, with this presentation.
We're probably going to have further discussion on this. We've the legislature's hired some personnel to come in and talk to us about tax credits and all that stuff. So we'll, this is not the last we're going to see of this discussion. This is an introduction of what's coming. You know, it's good to review this, to talk to Dan. He's pretty knowledgeable on this. He knows at least six definitions of what chemically altered means. And inside one here. And so I'd suggest members get familiar with what these are and what it is, because it has a lot to do with Alaska's future and what we're doing with our current revenue situation.
Chairman Newman, I'm not sure if you've got the supplemental packet that we sent over today, but there was a nine-page report there that really describes in more detail each of those credits. So.
Is Dan available to explain that to everybody?
Yes. Anytime you want him.
Thank you. So we didn't know if we could get it, but we're going to do an overview, try and get that one in yet for the Department of Revenue. And Commissioner, if you want to introduce the folks that you need to get there, I think everybody pretty much knows Jerry. Back again, he kind of comes and goes. And then we talked about issues a lot when we did that meeting. Kind of maybe in some of your slides, if you have some of the issues that we talked about, major issues, there isn't very much within the Department of Revenue's budget.
Yes.
That we can really alter a lot in through their personnel costs. Just mention those as we go along, please.
We will do that. And for the record, Jerry Burnett, the Deputy Commissioner of Revenue, will be handling the budget overview for the committee.
For the record, my name is Jerry Burnett. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, and I'm going to go through this relatively quickly and stay at a very high level, and if you have any questions, I'll try to answer them. And I want to note that our Administrative Director, Dan DiBartolo, is in the audience, so he can give me answers to any questions I don't know the answer to.
Jerry knows how to speak into that mic.
Okay, so starting with the major programs in the Department of Revenue, we got the tax division, which collects taxes, forecasts, report revenues, and regulate charitable gaming, and the treasury division, which manages invested state funds other than the permanent fund, the permanent fund dividend division, which administers the PFD program, distributes annual dividend payment to eligible Alaskans, and we administer the Pick, Click, Give, and the Alaska College, you know, we collect for the Alaska College Savings Program. Their Pick, Click, Give, by the way, is doing a little better this year than last year. I think giving's up about 15% or so over same time last year. Child Support Services Division, which collects and distributes child support to custodial parents and to the state for those people who are in state cut. Where children are in state custody or under state program. It's a organizational chart for the department. You see the commissioner at the top, the two deputy commissioners, myself and Donna Keppers. Donna's located in Anchorage, and she's our lead on the AKLNG and the administrative oversight for the tax division and the criminal investigation unit. And the other divisions fall under me, and then we have the four corporations, the authorities and corporations. Alaska Housing Finance is in the department. The commissioner has a seat on the board that provides Alaskans access to safe, quality, and affordable housing. You've probably heard of it before. The Permanent Fund Corporation, which invests the permanent fund, and the commissioner also has a seat on the board of that. Mental Health Trust Authority, which administers the Alaska Mental Health Trust. And that one, we do not have a seat on the board. It is a board, but it's administratively within our department, and we provide a large number of administrative-type services for the Mental Health Trust Authority. Municipal Bond Bank Authority provides municipalities with financing options for capital projects, and that's actually within our Treasury Division administratively and actually has two half-time employees and a loan portfolio that's nearing $1 billion. So it's a very lean thing. But
well, then all these are overseen by their own individual boards, respectively. They don't fall under the Budget Act. And so
right.
I guess your job for managing is pretty easy. You don't have very many personnel on.
Right. No, those are, we don't, although the Municipal Bond Bank, because the employees within it are also half-time Treasury employees, they're within our purview directly, but you're right. The administration of those programs is done by the board and an executive director for the most part. But they do show up in our budget. So in 2014, we consolidated leases, combined public-facing offices to reduce billable footprint for cost savings. We reviewed and updated all of our regulations, and that's an ongoing, continual process. In the Treasury Division, we had 33 of our 36 funds managed by Treasury met or exceeded the benchmark returns. The PERS and TERS funds returned 18.5% approximately as compared to 12.5% and 12.59% in FY13. And the actuarial assumption on those is 8%, so it's exceeding the actuarial expected return. The tax division could...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Briefly, Jerry, first of all, public-facing offices, I assume you mean open to the public? And if so,
public-facing offices would be those, our offices where we have people that can come in for a child support or a PFD question or a tax payment, a tax. So those are the ones we're talking about. So
open to the public, okay.
Okay.
And where were those, just offhand? Where are those two?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we have in Juneau and Anchorage, we have had our offices outside of the, well, our main offices are in the Atwood building and the state office building. We had satellite offices in other offices, and we're trying to get them all together so that we're, if you look at Anchorage, if you go to the Lenny Pasillo parking garage, you'll see that PFD and child support are right there, so you don't even have to cross the street if you park in the garage in the public parking. So they're handy for you.
Department of Administration is rounding them up in their office saving space.
Right. Okay. The tax division, we are continuing the implementation of the tax revenue management system, rolled out the first phase in April of 2014 for corporate income and excise tax filers. We have online filing options for all taxpayers. We have the oil and gas property tax. A portion of it's online in 2014. In January, we actually rolled out the oil and gas production tax in the new system and rolled in the information for the last several years. So that will make it much quicker for our economists and our tax auditors to compare, do statistical work, and get audits done in a timely manner. Plus, it's much easier for our taxpayers, particularly in the oil and gas, where we were getting information sometimes in paper, sometimes in different formats, and now they're able to file it all, the information online. It's, I think it's going to be a big improvement for everybody, and it'll speed up the process. We think that 98% plus of our known taxpayers filed their tax returns, so that's pretty good, and made their payments. Permanent Fund Dividend Division, we contacted over 90% of our eligibility cases by the time the dividend amount was announced, so we're doing a better job of getting out in front and getting out everything dealt with before people get complaints, before they have to call you, before they call us. We don't like to get those calls either. So they're getting their highest case closure rate since 2008. They are increasing their interactions with the public by doing it more efficient through phone, email, in-person. They've changed processes, though, over the past several years, which have made it much better for the public, in our opinion. They focus on improving communications with other state agencies. We have to have collaborative efforts between MyAlaska, DMV, and Vital Statistics. In 2014, at the beginning of the filing season, we had a number of people whose names didn't match up between DMV and the PFD system, so they couldn't do a online signature. And I think we've got that pretty much cleared out. It can still, those are the types of things that we're working on improving, but we're aware of to the extent possible. And I know I can see a representative over here who still does see some issues on occasion.
Jerry, so I'd like you to tell us whether this is going to be fixed over the permanent fund dividend division. I'm quite positive I applied for my PFD 2 years ago. Somewhere got lost in the MyAlaska system. I didn't appeal it. Or I secretly moved out of state and sent a twin here. But forget about that. But so then my next year's, for last year's PFD, I had to fill out extra paperwork because I didn't get one the year before. And I started calling, and for months I would call, and it would reroute me so I could talk to a human being, and eventually I'd get cut off. And I didn't have time to deal with it, and this went on for months. And, you know, because I work in the building, I know what parts of the division to call, and eventually I got through to a human being. But are other people still going through this? Because that's...
Through the chair to Representative...
It's happening to other people.
Through Representative Guerra, I will have to talk to our PFD Director, Sarah Race, about that specific issue, but that is a phone queue that we have been working on and improving over the past several years, and it has features that will, you can leave the queue and it will call you back, or it will have a person call you back. There are other features that to avoid that problem that you had, and so
we've all had issues with PFD clients, and we could sit and talk about this for
right. But
I just want to know whether it's working, Mr. Chair.
I think
if you're concerned about your number one constituent.
No, his 2 year PFD, it's too late for that. Although I think he could have, candor, it is possible. If I could, sometimes people do try to apply, they're unsuccessful, they think they were successful. Generally, when that happens, if they contact the PFD division, we can determine whether they tried to file, in which case we will accept a late application, but not 2 years late.
I think Jerry's right. There was a change in regulation about 2 years ago that does go back, again, right, to basically a one-time mulligan, for lack of a better term. You know, somebody thought they mailed it in, they didn't get it, for whatever reason. They do have that option back again.
Hey, Mr. Chair, that's not my question.
Last time.
My question is, I would get to the point where I could leave a message or somebody would call me back and the phone would hang up. I'm just wondering if you've looked at that part and fixed that for people.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I don't believe that that's still happening, but we will review it again.
You can always call Mr. Burnett.
And you can call us.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Guerra, 2 years ago, I had a little problem, and like you said, you're here in the building. I walked across the street, walked up, and somebody came to the counter and straightened it all out. So you have that available to you here, as long as you're in Juneau.
I don't care about me. I care about the phone hanging up on people.
And so do we, to be. Yeah. Child support, we actually do statistics for the federal government every year on child support, so you can see our efficiency rate here, meeting always meeting minimum standards, which we have to do in order to get our incentive payments from the federal government. And so I think we're looking good there.
This, I think, is an important thing that we need to look at, not only because of the people it affects. I think the Department of Revenue has done very good. I believe there was an audit done several years ago that looked at the efficiencies of this, found the department is very good. I think within the first 6 weeks, almost 94% of all cases are done. Okay. Just there's a human factor there. Representative Wilson made sure I said that. Go ahead.
Okay, and then looking back at activities from, 10 years ago, we're collecting, even in FY14, we were collecting more revenues than we were in FY05, but we have added a number of new programs since then and many changes to the oil and gas production tax, the funds under management by the Treasury Division 10 years ago were about $20 billion, now they're over 50. The last couple of years, the Treasury has had more money than the permanent fund most of the time. And that may end this year if we're spending down, but it'll be real close still. Number of dividends paid has gone up. We've had Pick, Click, and Give program. We are dispersing more money in child support.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So where do audits fit in all this? You do audits of the tax of the oil companies, and we get that all the time.
Okay. Through the chair to Representative Wilson, in terms of the tax division audits, I would say that audit activity in the tax division, they have a statutory framework in which they have to complete all audits. Some of the audit activities in the tax division have been down a little bit over the last couple of years because of installation and startup of the tax revenue management system. And now people, about, in many cases, 35%, half of the staff time has been spent changing systems, and now we're going to be able to, now that we have it online, get back to the regular business. And I think that's a serious question. It's
follow up?
Yes.
What year are we on? I mean, that's all I want to know. Are we on 06, 07? Where are we?
Let's see, subtract 5.5 years, and that's where we're at. So it'd be 08, 07.
We really haven't caught up at all. We kind of still stay at the same place, but hopefully with the new system.
There's two components, the new system and the fact that the PPT audits are completed, which takes another whole component out of the process, is going to help speed up the audits.
And since the public, and I think this is important, although you may be auditing 2006, it doesn't mean that companies haven't paid. This is just a check to see whether or not you and the company agree on what their tax liability is.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson, we buried down on them pretty good on that, to make sure that there wasn't non-completed audits before the six-year deadline. Yeah. And they keep up with them fairly close as they're coming in, and the ones that are out there 6 years are pretty minimal. And so we asked what their track record was. Average, pretty balanced out, I believe. But you can double-check with them when you want. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I got two questions briefly. There was a question raised about the how recently the ACEs, tax audits under ACEs have been done. Can you briefly characterize the complexity of the tax audits of ACEs versus others? And a secondary question about permanent fund payments, but I'll get to that.
Lenny, are you still online?
No.
Is not online. Lenny would be the one that could, as the audit master, could talk about the complexity.
There he is.
Mr. Deese. Did you hear
that? Yeah, this is Lenny Deese, audit master with the Department of Revenue. I'm still online.
Lenny, the question was whether you could talk about the complexity of the ACES audits in relationship to PPT audits and how that affects our ability to get those audits out.
Okay. Well, as you know, ACES and PPT are both net tax systems, so they're very similar. There were some changes in ACES, however, that added a little bit of complexity to the audits. One I can think of off the top of my head is the reasonable cost of transportation. It's where the department will determine what's to be a, if you will, a tariff for certain pipelines that are owned by, you know, some of the producers who may have a company that owns the pipeline company, where we, the department does actually have to calculate what a reasonable tariff. That's one complexity. The other complexity had to do with the maintenance cost that was being done as a result of all the problems that occurred in 2006 at Creole Bay. So we have to look out for those particular activities. But the most complex thing about the audit is the audit of lease expenditures. I mean, they're just the amount of activity that the auditors have to look at, and not having the data in a consistent manner was something that you know was a little bit difficult for the auditors. But with the new TRMS system that we have, we're going to be able to collect data in a more consistent basis. Have a data warehouse, if you will, of information that will make it easier for the auditors to look at the expenditures, and that's basically it. And also, there was the learning curve of you know, going from a gross to a net tax system.
Lenny,
there was a learning curve for the auditors, Lenny, in terms of understanding the operations of the industry.
I think we got it, Lenny. Thank you, Mr. Neese. Yeah. Deese. You know, I just tend to look at that, too, as a complexity. You've got all the standard allowable deductions on 35% to 40% or 45% for 2 years of all the upstream costs that are put into all exploration and development in the state. That's a lot of information to see if it qualifies or not.
Okay. You had one other question?
No.
Okay. Okay, well, if we can go forward, just to give you the department's budget as it relates to the rest of the department and what's happened over the past many years since 07, you see that actually over in the box on the side it says it's decreased, but it should say it's increased. I think this slide came from legislative finance, but we should have fixed that when we saw it. So. We're 0.61% of our operating budget internally is 0.61% of the state's general fund budget. So it's not a big deal. And this just shows which divisions they are. And taxation and treasury includes the tax division, the treasury division, and the permanent fund dividend division. So child support's on its own. So that's why it looks much bigger than the rest of them. Appropriations here at all funds. You can look at these. And then the governor's budget by fund source. And you can see that the biggest fund source in ours is permanent fund corporate receipts. And that's in the permanent fund corporation's operating budget. That's primarily used to pay management fees for their investments. The pension funds is similar, the next one. Federal funds is primarily in the child support services and the Alaska housing components, Alaska housing with public housing. And then the general fund is only 8% of our total budget when you look at the whole thing. And then this is showing the by the appropriation and a pie chart, and you can see the permanent fund is the by far the largest, and that's primarily their external manager fees. And the pension funds, again, the same, because there's large amounts of money under management. Key 2016 budget changes that you're going to see, and I'm going to go over these in a big picture way because we don't have the detailed budget back from OMB yet. You're seeing non-personal services reductions of about $1.7 million UGF, personal service reductions of about $1.5 million, and then this health insurance working reserve reductions are ones that are taken out of our budget as part of the payroll admin reductions and how much it costs for those things. So they're small amounts. We are adding positions in the department, both in the Permanent Fund Corporation and in the Treasury Division, and those are going to be paid for by reducing external management fees. So there'll be a net savings to both the Permanent Fund Corp and the pension funds from those position additions.
So. Very briefly, you're not adding 1,079 positions.
What's that?
Does it indicate you're adding 1,000 positions?
That's $1 million worth of positions.
Oh, good. I'm sorry.
It's $1 million worth of positions. So not 1,000 positions. I'd like to add 1,000 positions, but I'm not sure what we would do with them, and I sure wouldn't want to manage them. So anyway, the reductions in non-personal services are primary. There's some of that is federal funds because we're taking a reduction in child support, and it's matched. Some of that is pension fund and permanent fund corporate pension funds and permanent fund corporate receipts for management fees. And the details on this are coming probably next week, I believe. So. And then our capital budget is all in Alaska Housing's capital budget, and it's pretty small this year relative to past years. As money for weatherization, the teacher health, public safety, and VPSO housing loans, the HUD-Fed home grant, home energy rebate, housing urban development, capital fund program, and the cold climate housing research center. And that's funded with, you know, $17 million in general fund and $11.5 million in federal dollars there. And then wrap up, you know, the tax division's mostly spending a lot of time improving its information system, improving its efficiencies, and I think you'll see efficiencies in future budgets as a result, and faster audits, we hope, and better information. We're the largest investment manager in the state. Done a pretty good job with our investments over the past several years, and we're achieved and maintained the highest credit rating, the lowest cost of borrowing. We're going to be doing some general fund refunding bonds and a bond anticipation notes this spring or winter, and we expect to still get a good pricing on those. Interest rates are at historical lows, so we'll do well. And we've worked really hard on the customer service in PFD and child support. And for any of you who have been here for a long period of time, if you can remember the numbers of calls and complaints about child support and compare that to now, it's an incredible success story, in my opinion. And our corporations receive national recognition for program management and fiscal solvency. So, and that's all I have to say, unless you have any other questions. Commissioner Ryan.
Jim Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you, Jerry. On page 10, the graph that was prepared by Legislative Finance shows it looks like a $13 million reduction that doesn't quite match up with page 15, and I'm wondering if you could shed some light on that.
There's a one-time item in there, which I will have to get back to you on what that is, but there were one-time items sometimes in our budget, so I'll get back to you on that.
Okay, thank you. And then just one more question. Thank you. On the UGF personnel service reductions, which divisions are those targeted to?
Our general fund personnel costs are in the tax division, the treasury division, child support, administrative services, and the commissioner's office. So I hope I didn't leave anybody out.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Gare.
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to test this increased customer service efficiency at the Permanent Fund Dividend Division with a telephone call when we get out of this committee.
Okay.
Can we get a report back?
No. Not if it costs. And Child Support Division, and I know Representative Gare is pretty interested in that stuff, too. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Jerry. Did pretty good for your first time in the House, but you had a tune-up yesterday from the Senate. Tomorrow, we will be meeting at 1:30. We will have Alaska Mental Health and Trust Authority overview. I would imagine Mr. Jeff Jesse and the board will be here for that. Department of Education and Early Development overview. So be prepared for that. Representative Gass, do we have any information that we need for that?
For tomorrow?
For the Department of Education? Or?
Certainly our subcommittee is meeting this afternoon, this evening, but nothing for, I don't have anything to add to that.
Okay. Thank
Maybe
you.
I will tomorrow. We'll see.
Thank you, folks. So we will see you tomorrow.